Well, welcome back from me, Martin Handy, to the Royal Albert Hall Auditorium itself after that bibulous sojourn below stairs. And we've been witnessing a fantastically speedy transformation of the platform, instruments, stands, chairs, parts, a real spatial feat in itself. Ready for the second part of this three-part BBC prom being given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra with its artist in association, Oliver Nussen. All three works in this section of the concert are receiving their proms premieres with The Meat in the Sandwich, the first London performance of Colin Matthews' Violin Concerto, in which Lila Josefowitz is the soloist. After that comes Luke Bedford's Outblaze the Sky, inspired by the writing of D.M. Thomas. Well, with me in the Radio 3 box this evening is composer Julian Anderson. Julian, Ollie Nussen's an extraordinary figure in this country's musical life, composer, conductor, teacher, administrator, just hugely influential.
Yes, I think there must be now two generations of younger composers than him have been hugely indebted to him for his experience, his championship of their music, his teaching, and of course these marvellous performances that he gives of contemporary music and 20th century music, and he always plays it like repertoire, like, you know, with the love and devotion that and care that it needs. And so he's a hugely important figure, and of course he's also championed many other composers, not just younger ones, and Colin Matthews and Harrison Birtwistle are both composers he's played and recorded.
Sorry. I mean, do you like I mean, he's put the programme together. Do you like that? Is it the kind of evening a festival like the proms needs?
I think it has a festive air to it, particularly with Jubilee at the start and the Rhenish Symphony at the end. And I think that such tripartite programmes really work well if you've got a good shape to them. This has a very nice shape. It's like a well-cooked and well-presented dinner, and you really want to hear each piece in this order, in this succession. It will make, I think, a very good overall shape, yes.
Well, the first piece we're going to hear is a real pocket battleship, a three-minute work composed by Sir Harrison Birtwistle for the reopening of Severance Hall in Cleveland at the start of the millennium. Julian, you know the hall well. You were a young composer fellow to the Cleveland Orchestra a few years ago. The title of the piece is Sonnets Severance 2000. Obviously, the severance refers to the hall, the name of the original benefactor, in fact, but Harry uses it in another sense, too.
Yes, according to Paul Griffith's programme, he also uses it in the sense of meaning to stop things, to sever them, because the piece ends rather abruptly. And the sonnets is from the famous line in Henry V, let the trumpets sound, the tucket sonnets, and the note to mount. And Birtwistle creates a suitably exuberant three-minute explosion for orchestra, which is like a sort of summary of his orchestral style.
Yes, he packs an awful lot in, doesn't he?
He does. It's rather like those Carter pieces called Three Occasions, where in short duration you get a little summary of what the composer's musical world is like. And I think for people who don't know Harrison Birtwistle's music, this would be a very good place to start. A short three-minute burst with many layers of activity and different kinds of fanfare, different kinds of percussion writing and so on, full of colour and exuberance, a brilliantly shaped piece.
Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, as you can hear, is now on the platform. Andrew Haveron, the leader, has tuned the orchestra, and it's a fairly normal-looking symphony orchestra, we should have to say now, as Oliver Nussen returns to the platform to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Birtwistle's Sonnets Severance 2000. The trumpets played by John Holland left high and dry at the end of Harrison Burt Whistle's Sonnet Severance 2000. A summon to arms, Burt Whistle says, appropriate to launch a renewed hall. In this case, that of the Cleveland Orchestra. It represents a beginning and an end as the sound halts abruptly. A musical act of severance, its echo and the ongoing life of the hall continuing in time. Sonnet Severance 2000, performed to begin the second part of this BBC Prom, live on Radio 3 by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nusson. And so to tonight's concerto, Colin Matthews for violin, which was premiered last year in Birmingham by Oliver Nusson and Lila Josefowicz, who's also the soloist this evening here at the Proms. Matthews worked very closely with Josefowicz while he was composing the concerto, sending her sections as he completed them, so she was closely involved in its development. She asked to have the completed work a full year before she premiered it in Birmingham because, as Matthews admiringly says, she really learns new pieces, so they're fully in her head and muscle memory and she can perform them without music. Julian, it's a virtuoso work, no question, but it's not showy, is it? I mean, there are no cadenzas for a start.
It's not just show, of course. She is allowed display and virtuosity, but she's a wonderful lyrical player, and Matthews really brings that out in this piece. I must say, even at the dress rehearsal, she was playing it from memory, which is astonishing.
It is an amazing feat. And Colin Matthews uses quite a small orchestra in the concerto, just 12 violins, no first and seconds, though all the strings divide quite a lot. Foolish woodwind, a small brass section including two flugelhorns instead of trumpets, softer colour, and some interesting percussion, Julian.
Yes, a lute john, which is a little wooden slit drum, some claves, some metal bars, various things.
But what's a rototom?
Rototoms, which are toms that you can rotate, tom-toms that you can rotate, and they make a gliding sound as you rotate them. They get higher or lower.
Is the flexitone also that?
The flexitone is towards the end of the piece. You'll hear a wailing sound from the flexitone. But these are never used as special effects. They're integrated into the orchestral texture in a very subtle way. And the harmony of this piece is very characteristic of Matthews, particularly of the pulsating second movement, as I think you'll hear. Mm. There's a wonderful dark side to Colin's harmony always. And that comes out at that point, I think, in the work.
Yes, I mean, the two movements to the piece, and they're each about 10 minutes long, very different structurally, aren't they? The first one sort of slow, fast, slow, fast. And the second then runs, well, doesn't run at all, but it gradually moves from slow to fast in a very controlled fashion.
It's sort of Sibelius-like
thing
in a way, which although not like Sibelius's violin concerto, more like the first movement of the Fifth Symphony or something like that, gradually and steadily getting faster.
But starting, as you say, that second movement,
very dark, very bleak,
notes.
yes, and a wonderful long sustained line for the violin. I think the work is like a journey through a landscape. That is, of course, the title of one of his largest orchestral pieces, Landscape. And here, too, I feel that the soloist and the audience is taking a journey through the orchestral landscape, different shades of light and colour, different densities, different thicknesses, and wonderfully varied, but never monotonous, and wonderfully coloured, and a fantastic ear for sonority, but also large shape. The music never stays still. It's always going on to something else.
Particularly that second movement, the journey is very evident, isn't it? And those tolling notes almost stay with it to the end. It's just that the final burst of acceleration loses them.
Yes, I think we should also say that in the first movement, there are also, I think possibly conscious, echoes of the, very small echoes of the Berg violin concerto, which is in Lila Josefowicz's repertoire. The clarinets playing thirds and some lyrical lines from the violin and a rocking sound in the bass, which I thought when I heard it this morning might possibly be little tribute to that piece, but just very much in passing.
And also looking at the structure of it, that there are recurring themes in this piece that section to section and movement to movement. It's very integrated, despite the two movements and the sections.
Yes, and in fact, of course, at the end, the tune that the violin introduces and the first movement is brought back on the orchestra near the end in a very dramatic way.
Well, now all's ready here in the Royal Albert Hall, and here are Lila Josefowicz and Oliver Nusson to give the London premiere of Colin Matthews' Violin Concerto with the BBC Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was the London premiere of Colin Matthews' Violin Concerto, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall as part of tonight's BBC Prom by Lila Josefowicz, playing as she did the world premiere in Birmingham last year without music, but this evening with the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Oliver Nusson. And here comes Colin Matthews, bounding down the stairs onto the platform. Worked, as I say, very closely with Lila on that piece. Huge hug for both her and for the bear that is Oliver Nusson. And I think Colin Matthews delighted. He's applauding the orchestra with great vigour. He's extraordinarily busy at the moment, writing new pieces for the London Sinfonietta, the City of London Sinfonia, and the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra. A new piece we played with Beethoven's Eighth Symphony. It's part of a Beethoven cycle. Extraordinary performance. Julian Anderson with me here in the box by Lila Josefowicz. I mean, like Olli Nusson, she makes these new pieces sound like repertoire words.
Exactly, yes. Stunning playing and particularly well-sustained lyrical lines in that second movement, I thought. And then, of course, she has a race to the finish just at the end.
Yes.
And which she did brilliantly. I remember seeing the piece as it was being written. I bumped into Colin at a concert. He was handing her a fragment of it that he'd written, and I thought this was going to be something rather unusual. And indeed, so it proved.
And Colin
very
Matthews.
Special piece.
Yes, Colin Matthews. No Oliver Nusson, but Colin Matthews and Lila Josefowicz taking a bow there. I should say Lila Josefowicz, a very slight figure, but very flexible, involved physicality, arguing with the orchestra in a way there.
Yes, she's a very physical performer, and she has a wonderful sense of rubato, of pulling the tempo about, but never gratuitously, always sensitively to the musical needs. Marvellously flexible playing.
Well, as you said before, definitely some echoes, I'd say, of the Berg Violin Concerto, but of course, Colin's been spending 8 years alongside his other works orchestrating all Debussy's piano preludes. Can you hear any residues of Debussy orchestration anywhere there?
I'm not sure I can. I think that's a very different sound world, I would
yes.
have said. But possibly a few touches in the faster music.
Wonderful to see this new concerto has already achieving a real performance live. Some seven after the premiere, Lyon, Poland and Finland among them. Colin Matthews and Lila Josefowicz back on the platform.
It's nice to see British Violin Concerto is coming back into their own, also with Oliver Nusson's recent Violin Concerto a few
Peter
years
Maxwell
back.
Peter Davis as well.
Also, and they're all going into the international repertoire. This is really good.
And very well received tonight. I mean, even the applause between the movements.
Well, I rather liked that. I thought it was very nice to see that between movements in a contemporary piece, a piece new to the Proms, that the audience wanted to express its appreciation. One has perhaps mixed feelings sometimes about applause between movements, but it can be pleasant to have that, particularly with a new piece, as I say. It shows they're getting the point, they're getting the drift, and they want to show their appreciation.
Well, the last new piece in this second section of tonight's three-part BBC Prom here in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3, is by the young composer Luke Bedford. I remember presenting the Halle concert in 2004, which his BBC commission Road with Darkness was first performed. Very exciting piece, inexorably increases in intensity. That was the breakthrough piece for Bedford, really, and with it he won the Radio 3 Listeners Award, BBC Composer Awards. It sparked off several commissions, including one in 2006 from the LSO, which resulted in the piece we hear now, Outblaze the Sky. Julian, in a nutshell, how would you describe Luke Bedford's composing style? I mean, you taught Luke, didn't you?
I didn't teach him composing. He was in some of my analysis classes, but he studied composition with Edwin Roxburgh and Simon Bainbridge. This is a composer who knows how to focus his imagination. Mm. Imagination is a rich one, but each piece is a particular kind of world, and he explores that very, very thoroughly, and tonight's piece is no exception. He sets up a chord at the start of the work which, as it were, typifies the whole sound world of the piece, and which, by the way, resonates very, very well in this hall, as we heard this
indeed.
Morning in the rehearsal. And he explores the implications of that initial sonority beautifully and with great delicacy. It's a very refined piece. It's mostly a rather slow one. And it paces itself very gradually over its 6 minutes in a very mature and wonderfully somber way.
Luke was telling me this morning that, it is very sensual, very ecstatic music. But Out Blazed the Sky, he says, the title's a reworking of a phrase in D.M. Thomas's novel The White Hotel. And his music, he was particularly affected by an extended dreamlike poem in it about a man, Freud's son apparently, meeting a woman on a train and their passionate tryst in the White Hotel. Everything hyper-real. It's only 6 minutes long, Julian, but it sounds like sort of 21st century Scriabin in a way to me.
So I think that's a very good parallel, because as with Scriabin, you get a certain harmonic kind of world which is consistent, but beautifully varied within that range. I've not, famous novels one's never read. I should have read The White Hotel, I've never done so. So I'm not able to comment on the resemblance of it to that world, but certainly there's a hallucinatory quality to the orchestration. You can hear a haze, as he puts it, around every line, and that is very vivid, but not overdone.
No, I mean, the other thing is, and it's been common for these first four pieces, really, the percussion sound worlds. One of the great expansions of the orchestral palette in the last 50 years or so. I mean, it's a visual world, too, here in the Albert Hall, not just a sonic one, isn't it?
Yes, I think that it's now a normal part of a composer's armoury, if you want it there. The level of percussion playing in the world, and particularly in Britain, is phenomenal, and they can play marvellously lyrically, all with percussive sounds, attacks, all kinds of lines. It's not just hitting things, it's so much more refined than that, and this piece gives them a chance really to shine.
Yes, I mean, things like a bowed vibraphone, which I've never heard before.
That's a lovely effect, bowed cymbals, other things, very subtle use of the vibraphone, also with mallets. It's a very good colouring of the orchestra.
Well, here once again comes Oliver Nussen to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the first proms performance of Luke Bedford's Outblaze the Sky. Luke Bedford says the slow speed of that music means it only properly blazes in the final section, and it certainly does that. That was the first performance at the BBC Proms of Bedford's Outblaze the Sky, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nussen. Luke Bedford's already had two premieres this year, another commission for the Halle, one for the Belcher Quartet. This is the first performance of Luke Bedford's music at the BBC Proms. And Oliver Nussen is desperately seeking Bedford, you might say. He's somewhere in the building. We don't know whether he can find his way onto the platform. He's held his, on his, held his finger up as though he knows where he is, and yes. Well, he's never been onto the platform at the Albert Hall in a performance, so. And here he comes, Luke Bedford. Straight to Andrew Haveron, the leader of the Reese Symphony Orchestra, to shake his hand. Very, very warm applause. He's busy at the moment with an opera for the opera group, Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, The Seven Angels, libretto by Glyn Maxwell, will be premiered next summer. Worth looking out for with the lyrical gift that he has. Very warm applause from what is, for this sort of programme, really a very good house. And here comes Luke Bedford once more. Julian, what are your thoughts on that piece, briefly?
A wonderfully lyrical, very, very atmospheric work, which held a good spell over that audience. You could have had a pin drop as soon as that first chord happened, and it builds very, very subtly and gradually, and breaks off at the end on a sort of precipice feeling, a feeling of something momentous about to happen. But it's wonderfully controlled, and you could see that they really got the point of it. As you say, a nice full house with a very, very good arena representation, particularly warm applause from there. And I think that this kind of programme, which Oliver Nussen puts together, is very, very suited to the Proms and works very well here.
Well, this is where we reach the second interval in this evening's tripartite BBC Prom, live on Radio 3. When we return, the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Oliver Nussen will be by the Rhine. For music influenced by the river itself and the people of the Rhineland, they end with the Rhenish Symphony of the composer whose 200th birthday we celebrate this year, Robert Schumann. And before it, the magnificently vulgar Rheinischer Kirmes-Tänzer, Rhenish fair dances, written half a century ago by Bernd Alois Zimmermann and receiving their first performance at the Proms. But for the next 20 minutes, we hear from former headmaster Edward Jones, who for 10 years looked after his wife as she suffered the progressive disablement of dementia. But instead of the anticipated misery of losing the woman he loved, Edward found that their love was renewed in a surprising way and that the music they'd always shared continued to bind them together.
10 years when I would have expected, and the world expected, just misery, it wasn't at all. And for me personally, it was extraordinarily rich. It's a very positive story.
If you see her, say hello. She might be in Tangier.
I never, never for a moment saw myself as any kind of nurse looking after a sick person. I was a husband-lover who was not going to lose his lifelong wife. I was not going to lose all that. And I believed absolutely that she was still all the things that mattered. They were there. And the image that I had was that some kind of opaque curtain had come down, like at the end of a theatre performance, shutting us off. But behind the curtain, all the things that mattered were there. And I thought, well, you know, I can get through any curtain, and that was what I decided to do. I saw it as a challenge. I was not going to be beaten by this.
And the wire separation, it pierced me to the heart. She still lives inside of me. We've never been apart.
Beryl and I were married for 56 years. I met her 58 years ago at Durham University and fell in love with her instantly and forever. In the Students' Union, I happened to look across at a group of first-year students, and two heads parted, and I saw Beryl, and in that instant, I just knew. And in fact, I went back to my room and wrote home and said, I have seen the woman I intend to marry. I didn't speak to her for weeks afterwards. She was so unusual. I mean, all my girlfriends in those days, you know, sort of like Betty Grable and Hedy Lamarr, you know, slim, long legs and full figure and glamorous. Well, Beryl was tiny, just under 5 feet. Not glamorous in any way at all. And she had wide-set greyish-green eyes and rather rusty-coloured hair. I find it difficult, and always have found it difficult, to get a picture of her. But I would know her if I were blindfolded in the room, you know? I mean, there's a lovely quote in Middlemarch where Will Ladislaw is with Rosamund Vincey, who's a flighty piece, and Rosamund says,
"What is it that you gentlemen are thinking of when you are with Mrs. Casaubon?" "Herself," said Will. "When one sees a perfect woman, one never thinks of her attributes. One is conscious of her presence."
That's Beryl, bang, you know. I've always felt that. Never met anybody remotely like her at all. We were both studying English literature. I was a year ahead of her, and I stayed on for a year to do the diploma in education. So I finished that as Beryl finished her degree, and we got married instantly. So that's how it all started. I always say it was a 10-year stint that we did. But I know that in the year before that, we had begun to notice that if we were discussing something, Beryl would start a sentence and not be able to finish it. And I know that that was something that was remarked about Iris Murdoch when she actually was in public and found that she couldn't finish her sentences as well. And then Beryl had a series of sudden falls without any reason at all, so that she couldn't go out without me holding her arm. And there were two occasions when we both went down together. And at the beginning of 1998, she went up and saw a consultant neurologist. It was clear from the questions he asked and so on that really her memory was disappearing very rapidly, and with it went most of her vocabulary. And I'd made notes during the 10 years that Beryl was tackling dementia because I wanted to record things, because words became very scarce. She became almost silent, so any words she uttered were significant, you know. And we go out of this door here, and before I'd got 10 feet, "Have you shut the door? Yes. Have you locked it? Yes. Have you got the keys? Yes. Can we get back in? Yes." And by the time I got to the car, the same questions would have come many times. In the car, it would be, "Have we got petrol? Do you know where we're going? Do you know the way?" It was anxiety. And other passengers would say to me, "Doesn't it drive you mad?" Instead of it driving me mad, as soon as Beryl asked the question, I would answer it calmly. And when he came again, I would do the same. I'm quite sure that for people like Beryl anyway, they need to know they're loved and they're safe, because it must be a very frightening world. And I think a lot of the irritation and even the violence that people talk about, and, "Oh, you know, he's a changed character, he's now become violent." If I get frustrated, everybody says, "Oh, well, yes, that's natural, you know." What about her frustration when nobody takes any notice of what she's asking or saying, you know, or gets cross every time she asks? Of course, there were times when I didn't know quite how to respond to things, and perhaps I did. I showed irritability and puzzlement, and Beryl would always say, "But I love you." And when we went for walks, which we did a lot, when I could see the signs of restlessness and she wanted to wander off, I would say, "Shall we go for a walk?" She always responded straight away, "Oh, yes." Well, I think there were about 4 different walks, but we did them sometimes 3 or 4 times a day, just short walks. We became known as the Walking Joneses. Beryl would ask the same questions, and make the same comments on the same houses as we went. And I would always reply, in a calm or even jokey voice, it reassured her. Music was an absolutely essential part of our lives. I mean, all the children learned to play some instrument. I played the piano, self-taught and badly, but Beryl was taught clarinet while she was at her grammar school by a member of the Goossens family, actually. Not the great Leon Goossens, but his uncle or someone like that. And she also sang in choirs. She had a very good voice. She liked folk songs or Benjamin Britten's settings of them. She would come in the evening when I'd just ready to settle down, you know, and she would sit by me and she'd say, now I want to go home. I said, well, you are home. No, I mean my real home, where my parents and my sisters are. There's only a certain amount of putting off that you can do. And in the end, I had to say, well, you know, darling, actually, they're not around anymore. They'd be 110 if they were. They're dead. And she said, oh, that's a terrible thing to say. All these things were over many nights. But eventually one raining grey afternoon, Beryl, standing by the door, she would rattle a chain trying to get out, you know. I know where they are. I want to go and see them. So I said, OK, we'll drive out to the country churchyard where they're buried. So we arrived and we sat in the rain. And after a bit, she looked at me and shook her head and cried. And it was the only time I ever saw her cry during this 10 years. We went home and she didn't ask about parents or sisters again. So I think something had been settled. And there were times when, you know, the real Beryl just shone straight through, a quick look, or she'd smile or occasionally say something even. I can well remember one occasion. And by this time, she wouldn't have had more than a year to live. And she was sitting in that chair, and we had a piano concerto, I can't remember what it was. And it finished off with a great flourish, and Beryl said, yes! Punched the air, you know. So we shared. I mean, music was a great resource for us because we didn't have actually to say anything. We just listened. And I felt no need to sort of interrupt and say, shall we do this and that, you know. Inside, she was, I'm sure, quite secure. And on one occasion, and one occasion only, she lifted her head suddenly and she said, I'm not frightened, you know. She loved Ravel, particularly the second movement, the slow movement of Ravel's piano concerto. She liked Bob Dylan and she loved Kind of Blue, but she would listen to really anything. I've always been a restless person and I would have thought that those long wintry afternoons and so on together would have killed me off, but in actual fact, I became restful, you know, it was amazing. Music had a big part to play in that. I have a great belief, and it came stronger and stronger, was that we may lose things intellectually, just memory, you know, like photograph of this and that. But I just believe that love is stronger than any of those things. You know, you have to keep showing it, touching every time, squeezing, kissing, and by the tone of voice too. And I think that's where the questions come in, because the anxiety is very strong. And so you have to reinforce constantly, yes, I love you. Yes, I will look after you forever. When I met Beryl, I was in a psychological turmoil. I'd just come out of nearly 5 years in the Air Force. I was at university and didn't know what I was doing there. It was only by chance that I got there. But Beryl, although only just a year out of school, I found she carried, even in that time, it wasn't an aura, but a sense of calm. I'm centred, I'm here, and I used to envy that so much, but I reached for it through her. She was very happy with the quiet, which made her an obvious natural Quaker. It was she, really, who got me along to Quaker meetings. And in times of difficulty, she was able to absorb these things into her silence. Towards the end, in the last 2 years, when she was actually wheelchair and special chair bound, she was about 98% silent. And that was why it was important to me to listen to the words that she'd still got. And I can remember them now. Sat there one evening, she said, "Where's my husband?" "I'm your husband." "No, no, no, I mean my real husband, Edward, my husband." I said, "Well, actually, I am Edward, your husband." This would be repeated and repeated. And she puzzled that over. Eventually, it was, "Well, why are you here? Why isn't he here?" And there came the point where I said, "Listen, darling, all our married life, you've been the strong one. I'm the one who's absolutely lent on you." And by golly, that was true. "But now you need someone to lean on, and your old husband, Edward, can't do it, but the new Edward husband can, and that's me." You know, these moments are sort of etched on my heart. She looked up, and her face was sort of radiant. She said, "Will you?" I said, yeah. "What a wonderful idea. Will you really?" And again, that particular thing wasn't mentioned again. I woke up this one morning and Beryl was looking at me very intently, and she said, "What do you think my husband would think about this?" So I said, "Oh, he'd be delighted, would he?" I said again, "I am the new Edward, and I am looking after you and living with you and sleeping with you as the old Edward did." And then on this one morning, because this goes on over many days, she asked the same question. I gave the same answer. And she said, "I like you. I think I could love you." And then she said, "I think I could fall in love with you." I felt that there had been this progression of questions right up to the only one that really mattered. And after that, words didn't really matter much at all. Richard Strauss, these four last songs were written to his wife, whom he lived with and loved for a very, very long time. And the last two, especially the last one, they are so straight to the heart. There's an 84-year-old writing this passionate music. That's how it ought to be. I am an old man, I'm 85. The last 10 years of a long life so often gets frittered away. When people said to me, But Edward, you have a life of your own, you know. You could go on a cruise. Very well-meaning people. But it seemed to me the obvious thing that old people should be doing was examining themselves and learning from it. Otherwise, with Yeats, you have to shout, what is it? An aging man is but a paltry thing.
An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless his soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress.
Mortal dress. I'm very strongly drawn to that part of T.S. Eliot in Four Quartets, East Coker, where he says, old men ought to be explorers. We must be still and still moving. I found that reading Rilke has really helped me to explore, particularly myself. And the great Duino elegies that he wrote, they are amazing. But his ninth one, which I think is my favourite, goes on to say, but what should we say when we get to that other place?
But into the other relation, what, alas, do we carry across? Not the beholding we've here slowly acquired, and no here occurrence, not one. Sufferings, then, above all the hardness of life, the long experience of love, in fact, purely untellable things.
During that 10 years, I learnt about myself. Not wholly to my delight, but I knew that there was a lot of learning for me to do. At least one of my children has been very sharp in reminding me, well, it was all right for you, you know, sort of thing. And there's no answer to that, except that I felt that Beryl had absorbed what was, she was there enough. And the helpers that came were absolutely adamant about this. They said, there's no doubt, you know, Beryl is there. It's just a question of how one accesses it. And that is what I saw my job as I say right at the beginning. I'm not a nurse. I am, you know, an anxious lover, if you like, not going to lose this fantastic woman. Because she gave me my life, there's no question about that. And when people used to say, meaning well, of course, but Edward, you have a life of your own to lead. I just said, well, you know, she is my life. There's nothing more to be said. And I shall go on learning. I've always been a late developer. I've come very late to these things, but because of Beryl, I did come to them. Without her, I'd have sunk without trace.
That was Edward Jones. The reader was Sean Baker. The musical Path Through Dementia was produced by Maria Burgess. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handy, to the final part of this BBC Prom, live here on Radio 3, given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Oliver Nusson. It's been quite a journey through four works receiving their first Prom's performances, and there's one more to come. So don't forget that if you'd like to have another listen, this concert will be available on the iPlayer for a week. Just go to bbc.co.uk/radio3 and the BBC Proms and then find the right one. Or you can hear it on Radio 3 itself again, Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Well, the main work coming up, the Symphony Schumann, was inspired to write by the sights and sounds of the Rhineland, particularly Cologne with its tremendous Gothic cathedral. Bernd Alois Zimmermann grew up in that city during the difficult period between the two world wars. Difficult or not, young Zimmermann would have had plenty of opportunities to hear the folk music of the Rhineland, particularly that performed traditionally at the festivities taking place during the carnival period before Lent, Cologne yielding to no one in the energy of its celebrations. Zimmermann's Rheinischer Kirmes-Tänzer, Rhenish fair dances, seem to have originated in piano arrangements of folk tunes written some 60 years ago for radio broadcasts. Then, years later, when he was wrestling with his huge opera Die Soldaten, the soldiers, he decided to get away from its problems by doing something completely different, and he arranged the suite for 13 wind and brass instruments. Well, the composer Julian Anderson is listening to this Prom with me in the Radio 3 box. Julian, this is pretty different from most music by Zimmermann, a real piece of music or fun.
Yes, it's light music really, and it fulfills that purpose very, very elegantly. And in any style he wrote in, Zimmermann was an expert orchestrator. He knew instruments really inside out, and you hear the relish of sound and the enjoyment of writing and arranging these dances in a perfectly straightforward but very witty and inventive way.
Yeah, I mean, he treats the material with ironic irreverence. I mean, he spoke of himself, it's a bit like Poulenc, I suppose, as a mixture of Monk and Bacchus.
Yes, this is definitely the Bacchus side.
Yes, isn't it? Just
as the last orchestral piece he wrote, Stille und Umkehr, Stillness and Return, is very much the Monk side. You know, in this piece, as in that one, rich colours, beautiful sensitivity, instrumental possibilities, never vulgar.
Do you know if he would have heard Kurt Weill, Hindemith, as a teenager? Do you detect anything like that?
Well, given when he was born, let me just do a quick bit of maths. I don't think as a teenager he could have done, because
they would already have...
They would already, alas, have been banned by the Nazi regime, which traumatized his adolescence and early adulthood very badly. But he certainly would have heard them straight after the war, and he obviously knew their work. I wouldn't say this is that much like them, though. It's a straightforward, enjoyable rendition of some little folk tunes.
Perhaps it's more like Stravinsky Pulcinella, that kind of feel.
A little bit. Ollie Nussen said earlier today to me that he thought it actually resembled the sort of Malcolm Arnold Cornish Dances type of thing, and I think that's true too. There's that. As I say, it is light music, beautifully done, very enjoyable.
Well, we're not just getting a Proms premiere tonight, but a world premiere. The double bass part wasn't included when these dances were published. This is its first performance, played by four of them in the first dance. It's completely manic. So here once again is Oliver Nussen to conduct members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Zimmermann's Rheinische Kirmes-Tänze. Thank you. Real Weissbier and Bratwurst music. Wonderfully raucous wind band sounds from Bernd Alois Timmermann in his Rheinische Kirmestänzer, Rhenish Fair or Church Festival dancers performed here at the Royal Albert Hall for the first time at the Proms by members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Oliver Nussen, and the double bass part not published and discovered in a manuscript version of the dances given its world premiere by four members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra bass section. I think we can say that the players reacted to Ollie Nusson's remark at rehearsal today. By all means, err on the side of vulgarity tonight, and I won't be unhappy. It sounds awfully civilised, he said this morning. Bit more schwung, chaps, please. Well, he's back on the platform, bringing them all to their feet. Hope he's pleased with the schwung tonight. It's not just a love of the Rhineland, which Timmermann and Schumann had in common, but bouts of severe depression, and Timmermann took his own life in 1970 at the age of 52. Well, as I said, the final work in tonight's Prom was also inspired by the Rhineland. Schumann wrote his Third Symphony soon after he'd been appointed music director of the Rhenish city of Düsseldorf, at a time when the prestige and opportunities of the position seemed enticing and exciting, before he grasped quite how difficult it would all be for him. The single most important catalyst for the symphony was a trip Schumann made just upriver to Cologne, where the wonderful Gothic cathedral thrilled him, and in whose cavernous interior he witnessed the Archbishop being solemnly invested as a cardinal. This symphony was the one time Schumann abandoned a four-movement structure. There are three inner movements, of which the last is that solemn, dignified portrait of the cathedral. The first and fifth are full of energy. On the one hand, maybe, a reflection of the strong current of the Rhine. But, Julian, surely there's more to the symphony than just pictures of the sights and sounds of the Rhineland. Perhaps odd to say of Schumann in a way, but this music's full of the sheer joy of life, isn't it?
Yes, well, that is a very important aspect of his creative personality. And, of course, the first movement is as a real headlong rush, marvellous, expansive music, which never seems to let go. As Stephen Johnson points out in the programme note, that Nielsen, Brahms, various other composers, obviously very struck by that. But the piece, yes, has its darker undertones, as Schumann usually does. And perhaps those come forward a little bit towards the end of the work in the finale and various other places.
The Rhine, of course, a very potent symbol to Germans. Calling it the Rhenish, also proclaiming his nationalism, do you think?
Yes, I think so. Of course, it didn't have the overtones, nationalism and German nationalism,
no,
in particular, that it does now. But yes, this is clearly somebody saying, this is the part of the world I feel most at home in, and relishing it in a rather idealistic vision, which, as you say, was not perhaps matched by the reality.
The symphony, another step in his quest for unification of his musical material in all his works?
Yes, well, he was often having these motto themes and idéfix and things that go through the piece, and that's the case here too. But also great diversity on the surface, a great diversity of mood and character and scoring.
Yes, Oliver Nussen says, or I think said to the orchestra, you know, think of it in terms of Mendelssohn rather than in terms of Brahms. It's that lightness you need in this, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well, we now, finally, you might say, have a classic symphony orchestra configuration on stage. It really has been, well, a very visual feast in all ways tonight, and I must say everybody's done amazingly well to get this programme on and up and running, with a very patient Proms audience as well. Well, this symphony was introduced to the Proms by Henry Wood, what wasn't, in 1901, but it was over 50 years until its next performance. Well, to conduct the performance tonight, here comes the BBC Symphony Orchestra's Artist in Association, Oliver Nussel, bringing the BBC Symphony Orchestra to its feet before he leads them in Schumann's Third Symphony, the Rhenish. A blazing end to Schumann's Salute to the Joys of Life and the Rhineland. In his third symphony, The Rhenish, it's been performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's three-part BBC prom by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Andrew Haver and conducted by Oliver Nussen. Well, Dusseldorf, not a great success for Schumann. He wasn't really a conductor. After 3 years as music director, he was forced to resign. But when you have a composer who can conduct like Oliver Nussen tonight, it does bring an extra dimension to the music. Well, my guest this evening, Julian Anderson, will be back here, I'm sure, on the 7th of August when the National Youth Orchestra, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, give the London premiere of his Fantasias. I hope it's a fantastic evening for you, Julian, and thank you so much for your company this evening.
Thank you so much.
Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back at the Proms on Monday when Jonathan Nutt conducts Ravel and Ligeti. It's joined by Pierre-Laurent Aimard for Mozart's Last Piano Concerto and the London premiere of George Benjamin's First. But as Oliver Nussen comes back onto the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall, time for me to leave you, just to tell you that in the first of tomorrow evening's two BBC proms, Paul Lewis continues his Beethoven piano concerto cycle with the second concerto. Rapturous applause for Oliver Nussen, trying to get the BBC Symphony Orchestra to stand. Finally, the principal cello does. Well, as I say, Andrus Nelson's and the CBSO tomorrow evening, including the Dvořák New World Symphony. That's at 7 tomorrow here in the Royal Albert Hall, live here on Radio 3. But for the moment, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House to host the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as he was saying earlier on, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Monday afternoon, this coming Monday afternoon, at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, well, just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, in 5 minutes' time here on Radio 3, the BBC Proms composer portrait, Colin Matthews tonight, whose violin concerto you may have heard in the second part of tonight's prom. Colin Matthews in conversation with Tom Service. That's at 10:15. And then at 11, the essay this week about writers who play a musical instrument and how their playing relates to their lives as writers. Journalist Jasper Rees tonight about the challenge of relearning the French horn and even playing live at the Royal Festival Hall. That's the essay at 11 o'clock tonight. For the moment, back to Robert Schumann, one of his three romances, Opus 94, clarinetist Gervaise de Paille here with pianist Gwyneth Pryor. Thank you. Robert Schumann, the last of his three romances, Opus 94, the clarinetist there, Gervaise de Pyre, with the pianist Gwyneth Pryor.
Sir Simon Rattle brings an evening of passion to the BBC Proms as he conducts the Age of Enlightenment, playing Wagner and Berlioz. Berlioz regarded the love scene from Romeo and Juliet as one of his greatest achievements and inspired Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Hear both pieces in the company of Andrew McGregor at the BBC Proms this Sunday at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
My apologies for the dropout at the start of that. It's 10:15 now, and now with the first of this year's BBC Proms composer portraits. It was recorded at the Royal College of Music before this evening's prom, during which we heard the violin concerto by Colin Matthews. Well, here's Colin Matthews now in conversation with Tom Service.
Welcome to the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music for this first of four composer portraits of this year's proms. Tonight, the chamber music of Colin Matthews in the spotlight, with performances by students and fellows of the Royal Academy of Music, duos for cello, viola, violin and piano. And I'm delighted to be joined on stage here by Colin Matthews, who's also Prince Consort Professor at this very institution at the Royal College of Music. Look, Colin, we're going to start with one of your five duos, and the first of the enigmas for cello and piano. So just tell us briefly about these pieces before we hear them.
Yep, these are sets of respectively five pieces and three pieces for cello and piano, both of which date from the 80s, I think. The enigmas were written for Sandy Bailey, who gave the first performance of my first cello concerto at the Proms in 1984, and I think I wrote them in 1985. The duos were written for another cellist, Richard May, who gave the first performance around 89. And they're quite similar in mood. In fact, enigmas could have gone for all of them. They're pieces that I didn't want to give explanations for, and they're slightly cryptic. So we have the five duos, which are very... The first one, the duo is very static, almost monodic in a way, with a long singing melodic line, and then it's followed by a very contrasting first of the enigmas, which contrasts pretty violent music with also relatively quiet and flowing music.
Fantastic. Well, look, let's given that you don't want to explain this enigma properly, then we should just hear the music, I think. Please welcome on stage Chris Hopkins, a pianist who will be playing for all of tonight's concert, and cellist Jonathan Rees.
Thank you.
Colin Matthews, Enigma No. 1 for cello and piano, and before that, the third of his five duos for cello and piano, played here at the Royal College of Music by cellist Jonathan Rees and pianist Chris Hopkins. Colin, one of the things I noticed from looking at your publisher's Faber Music's catalogue is that there's not a lot of music, published by them at least, before about the late-ish 70s or mid-70s, when you must have been 30, if my math is right. Mm-hmm. So, what happened before then? You know, what was going on?
I was a late starter. I was writing, I suppose, I mean, I started relatively late and didn't write anything that I would consider to have any value at all until sort of my early 20s. A few pieces have just I've salvaged, but it really was about 73, 74 when I actually found something like a voice. So there isn't anything that really survives before then.
I mean, one of the things you were doing at that time in your 20s was you had extremely close associations with Oprah, with Benjamin Britten, and with the music of Gustav Mahler, working on the completion of the Tenth Symphony. I mean, was part of that difficulty because you had these two huge musical behemoths who you had to somehow find your own way around as a composer, Mahler and Britten?
Not really, because, I mean, both of them were the most extraordinary things to be involved with. And, I mean, gave me a great deal to build on. I suppose you could say, I mean, it was at the same time rather off-putting because I could evaluate what I was doing. But, I mean, I've always tried to be as self-critical as possible, and I just simply wasn't writing the music that I felt was coming out right.
So what were you... what were the things that, you know, made you want to be a composer then, apart from what sounds like the obvious difficulty of of dealing with a personality as self-critical as yourselves, Colin?
I mean, what the real circumstance that made me become a composer, I think, was hearing a lot of Mahler in the centenary year of 1960. I mean, I'd been, like everybody, had learned piano at an early age, but I hadn't really seriously thought about what career I would want to follow. And a couple of experiences around that time, I mean, for instance, being actually present at the first public performance in this country of Mahler 3, and the first full performance of Schoenberg Gurlieder, and those were such overwhelming experiences that, I mean, I came away from them just thinking there was nothing I wanted to do except compose, with very little ability or experience before then.
So I'm guessing there were a lot of sketches for vast choral and orchestral pieces.
Yeah, like everybody, yes.
So what about then that transition to the pieces that you did want to keep?
Well, the transition, I suppose, came from having found that although I was trying to work in a pretty intensely serial way, I was, I suppose, particularly influenced, I think, by the Maxwell Davis of the early 70s. But it just didn't seem to quite gel. And the strange juxtaposition was that about that time I came across minimalism in the form of Terry Riley in particular, and then the early Steve Reich. And it just pushed me into a direction where I could sort of cleanse the harmonic palette. I grew out of it very quickly, but it was a very youthful way of finding the way I wanted to work harmonically.
You see, Max and minimalism, that's a pretty unique... you know, compositional pedigree at that time, really anywhere, but in Britain especially. I mean, did you... I mean, how do you go about putting them together?
with difficulty, but I mean, I somehow came out the other side. I mean, the big seminal piece was my orchestral fourth sonata, which was completed in 1974. And I remember somebody, I think, who was actually being critical, described it as a mixture of Ligeti, Steve Reich, and Sibelius rescored by Leonard Bernstein. And although he actually meant it quite toughly, I was very pleased indeed with this, because that's more or less what I was trying to do.
Those are pretty good names, too. Mm. I mean, you know. Listen, we change the scale. I was going to say alas. I don't mean that at all. It would be nice to hear the fourth sonata, but we're not going to hear that now. We're going to hear music for viola and piano, two pieces, Scorivoli and Calmo. Briefly, Colin, on those.
The remaining pieces that we're going to hear were all written as birthday presents to individuals. I've done a set of four violin pieces followed by four viola pieces. And in fact, the viola pieces are the relatively more recent. The two are Scorivoli, which is a very fast, shadowy piece, and that's dedicated to my friend, the choreographer Ashley Page, on his 50th birthday. And a viola piece, Calmo, which was a birthday present for the Dutch conductor and composer Reinbert de Leeuw.
Fantastic. So to play them now on stage at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall here at the Royal College of Music, please welcome viola player Robert Ames and pianist Chris Hopkins. Thank you. Robert Ames, viola, and Chris Hopkins on piano, the two pieces by Colin Matthews, Calmo and Scorrevole. Colin, even in those two pieces we've heard, and the two cello pieces as well, there's a huge contrast going on between often music that with very fast music and very slow music. It's particularly the fast music that's intriguing, because you've written a lot of music. I'm thinking of works like the huge Song Cycle Continuum, or bits of the Horn Concerto, or an orchestral piece called Toccata Meccanica. Genuinely fast music, which there isn't a lot of in some kinds of new music. I mean, is it difficult to do, to write genuinely quick music?
I'm not sure. I find I'm very driven towards doing it. And in fact, what has been the problem for me is actually writing slow music, because I've got into the mode of writing fast. I mean, the particular problem is that it's very easy to write fast music, which is just a moto perpetuo, or what I would call sort of running on the spot.
You mean like
just very fast figuration? But what is difficult? Yes, that the minimalism aspect of it. But what is difficult is to actually give this music a harmonic momentum, which actually allows it to have real pace rather than a sort of fake movement.
So how do you do it then?
Oh, I'm not giving away my tricks.
okay. Well, maybe we can investigate Calmo a bit more then, because you're saying to me during rehearsal today that's a piece that has been like a sort of seed since you wrote it about 10 years ago.
It was a very important piece for me, because in it I found a simplicity of harmonic language, which I've been using even up to the violin concerto. I think I've now got to stop. But it's what I call a sort of blemished tonality, where the basic triadic shapes are always blemished by one of the, without getting too technical, one of the notes, the triad, is blemished by a minor second, either above or below it. It can be in any position. But it actually became a very fruitful way of developing harmony. And it's been used, I used it in Continuum, which actually expands on Calmo, and in a piece, orchestral piece called Turning Point. And it's not so important in the violin concerto, but it's there still.
Colin, the sense about, okay, inventing these sorts of systems for the harmonic expression, or whatever the technical language is, there must be an expressive reason, a poetic reason, or a human reason that you want to do this, to get this stuff out. I mean, listening to Calmo just now, it seems to me anyway, a kind of unafraidedly emotional, lyrical, moving piece of music.
Yes, I, but that for me is something that happens in retrospect. I mean, when I'm writing, it's purely a technical exercise. Sometimes when people have asked this, I've quoted Tchaikovsky, who said at some point, when I am least emotional, I am writing my most emotional music.
I wasn't suggesting necessarily there's an autobiographical or a kind of, a confessional aspect to this, to your music, but rather, there is you're trying to... there's an expressivity about this music.
Well, I do find that very important, that although it's great fun to be able to work on your own and do things which are technically very challenging and enjoyable to do, I'm aware that these things can become very dry and abstract. And I suppose one of the things I've been trying to do for a long while is to write music which is expressive, but not simply expressive. I mean, I like the expression to be complex, and to be able to draw people in and to make them think. I don't want it to be too easy.
We're all finding it very easy here tonight. That richness is I think we can hear very clearly in the next couple of pieces, the violin and piano pieces, Chaconne with chorale and moto perpetuo, especially that Chaconne with chorale. It comes from a very, seems to be a kind of deep and dark place.
I suppose so. It's, again, these are birthday present pieces. That the Chaconne was written as an 85th birthday present, I think, for Bertolt Goldschmidt, with whom I worked for many years on Mahler 10. He conducted the first performance in 1964. was a composer who whose music was completely forgotten until the 90s. In fact, I only discovered it. My brother and I used to go and visit him, and we had no idea that he was actually a major composing figure. He didn't talk about it at all, and gradually it emerged. And I mean, he suddenly produced these scores, which had been published by Universal Edition in the 1920s. And we discovered, you know, what a major composer he was. So he was a close friend and a remarkable person to get to know. He was a particular master of the chaconne, and so when I wrote a birthday tribute for him, I wrote what is quite a complicated chaconne. It's quite hidden, but there is a pattern that runs through the whole thing, and a chorale in the middle, which is actually rhythmically completely free. It's up to the players to how they place it.
A moto perpetuo, as you'll hear, is in classic fast Matthews mode, right?
Yeah, and that was written for Elliot Carter's wife, Helen, and was an attempt to sum up. She was a remarkably energetic figure, even into her 90s, and this was meant to sum up some of her energy.
So to play both these pieces, then chaconne with chorale and moto perpetuo, violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins.
Thank you.
Colin Matthews, Moto Perpetuo, and before that, Chaconne with Chorale for violin and piano. Violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins. We're returning in a way to really one of your musical roots, so the final piece we're just about to hear in tonight's programme, your arrangement of the final movement of Britten's Opus 60 Nocturne. What does this piece mean to you, Colin?
Well, I thought this evening I really should end with something by Britten because he's been such a major part of my life. And this is a fusion of Britten and Mahler because the Nocturne is dedicated to Mahler's widow, Alma. And I think the final movement is perhaps Britten at his most Mahlerian. And I wrote this, in fact, this is yet another birthday present because it was for the chairman of the Britten Pierce Foundation, Robert Carmuth, for his 60th birthday, and he's an amateur violinist. I thought it would be appropriate to make an arrangement of the sonnet from the Nocturne.
Britten, Mahler and Matthews. Violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins with Colin Matthews' arrangement of Britten's Nocturne, Opus 60, the sonnet, the final movement.
Thank you.
Colin Matthews' arrangement of the final sonnet from Benjamin Britten's Nocturne, Opus 60. Violinist Charlotte Reed and pianist Chris Hopkins. Well, that's the end of this first composer portrait event of the BBC Proms 2010. Three more to look forward to through the rest of the season. My thanks to all of the musicians from the Royal Academy of Music who we've heard this evening. Chris Hopkins, Charlotte Reed, Robert Ames on viola, and cellist Jonathan Rees. Of course, to Colin Matthews for being with us tonight, and to you all, ladies and gentlemen, for being here at the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music. Thank you all.
And that BBC Proms composer portrait of Colin Matthews was presented by Tom Service.
Vigour and adventure course through the Royal Albert Hall in tomorrow's BBC Prom. Joins the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra performing Beethoven's second piano concerto. Katie Durham is your host for the BBC Proms tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening. It's coming up to 1 minute past 11. And now the essay. This week, four writers are revealing an alternative talent for performing music. How did they start? How do they keep going? And a good deal more. Tonight, journalist Jasper Rees takes up the theme in When Writers Play.
But do you still play? I get that one all the time. You took up your old instrument, they say. You wrote a book about it, then co-wrote a stage version. But do you still play? It's a very good question. My relationship with the musical instrument I learned at school has been an off-and-on affair, the stress being on the off. I dropped the French horn like a stone after 7 years' desultory toil, the second I left school. In this, I know I am not alone. University beckoned, and beyond it lay life, the universe, and everything. My old horn didn't really have a part to play in that future. Well, not so far as I knew. I associated my youthful music-making with confusion and stress, fecklessness and trauma. Who on earth would volunteer to carry a sackload of that into adulthood? Of course, I didn't leave it entirely behind. Hearing the strains of a velvety solo on a Hollywood soundtrack, the horn being the only instrument you can pick up over a car chase, would be like bumping into a distant cousin at a family wedding in which the words spoken between us would go something like, "Great to see you again. We must get together sometime." While the unspoken ones would say the opposite. No, we really mustn't. I went back to my French horn when I was on the verge, the very ledge of middle age. Let's not go deep into what lured me. Unfinished business? Couldn't afford a Harley? It helped that I had belatedly fallen head over heels in love with classical music. There was also a pregnant whiff of self-reproach at the heart of my decision. Once upon a time, I told myself, you didn't give this instrument your best shot. So down came the horn case from the attic. In the cinematic version of this moment, the lid would open towards the camera, and the glow from within the case would irradiate my face like Indiana Jones finding the Ark of the Covenant, or Fagin inspecting his glittering jewels. And my old instrument, made by Josef Liedl from what was once Czechoslovakia, did indeed gleam after 22 years in the dark. The sound I produced on it did not. What happened next is another story. I found myself enlisting for the British Horn Society's annual festival. Euphoric, after joining in with a massed horn blow, I challenged myself to return in a year and perform the Mozart concerto I had distressingly butchered in a school competition at the age of 17. Derring do, I should add, is not really my thing. Not my forte, if you will. It's probably why I failed as a horn player in the first place. On top of ability, you need practically toxic levels of self-belief to master this above all instruments. It's very, very easy to sound bad on the French horn. That mouthpiece is punitively narrow. With such a small space for the embouchure to work in, a note will often come up with a crack running right down the middle of it. A split, we call it here. Or in America, a clam. The higher you go, the easier it is to split. And the more you split, the more the mouthpiece becomes the focal point for intense levels of physical and psychological pressure, resulting in yet further technical vulnerability. And so on. At least as a writer, it was possible for me to work on these things in the privacy of the professional day. I did my practice away from ears that might have been offended, and scrambled methodically up from a subterranean level of competence. My guide was Dave Lee, an earthy eminence grise of the horn world, who also became a drinking companion. There are splinter groups who believe in yoga and meditation, but alcohol, explained Dave, carefully over a bottle of wine, is the recommended tranquilizer for most horn players after a concert. Sometimes it works before, too. I also listened to Dave's pertinent advice on breathing and fingering, trilling and tonguing. In the months that followed, a little miracle happened. I made a place in my heart for the French horn that the 15-year-old me had denied it. Curious to locate the source of my intoxication, I went to the history books. In rarely thumbed tomes, summoned from the basement of the British Library, I found my explanation. The sound that emerges through the horn's narrow mouthpiece, the slender lead pipe and 16 further feet of tubing before it flares past the player's right hand and out of the bell, is unique. Where other orchestral instruments produce a noise that is the result of a process of manufacture, the horn is recognisably a descendant of man's first conical instrument. As I improved, I began to understand that I was rejoining a line of music makers which reaches all the way back to that first Stone Age man who picked up a ram's horn and blew into it. My first hurdle was to sound better than the priests who destroyed the walls of Jericho. Gradually thereafter, it was to improve on all the hornsmen from the instrument's prehistory. The Celts, the Romans, the Vikings, and of course Count Roland summoning Charlemagne's reinforcements to the battlefield with a temple-splitting blast on his olifant. The horn disappears from history for most of a millennium until it crops up again on the hunting fields of France. It was this sound to which Mozart paid ebullient tribute in his four horn concertos. The joy of returning was unconfined. As I disinterred the dormant musician inside me, I felt that I was somehow making amends for bygone failures. It would be a mistake to claim that I soared to new heights. All I know is that I became a much more dedicated horn player the second time around. I did that thing that most teenagers never quite find time for. I practiced my socks off. A routine was established. Grappling with the horn was my respite for an hour, or more often two, from day-long attendance at the keyboard and screen. All writers have consciously elected to spend their days alone, but some of us do crave company. Mine came from the French horn, from Mozart, and by extension from Josef Leutgeb, the Viennese cheesemonger and old family friend for whom he dashed off the concertos. On the 27th of May, 1783, the composer famously scribbled at the top of the first concerto he completed, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart takes pity on Josef Leutgeb, ass, ox, and fool. I know this is a solipsism, but it felt as if Mozart had taken pity on me too. All those epithets certainly applied to my horn playing. The ass, ox and fool in me was most apparent when I accepted an invitation to join an amateur orchestra. I shipped up to the first rehearsal to discover that while there was a full complement of strings and a cross-section of woodwinders, the only other brass player was a trombonist parked at the far end of the empty back row. I was to be first, second, third and indeed fourth horn. I soon recalled that sight reading was never one of my strengths, nor was counting, and nor, worst of all, was transposing. A look of deep befuddlement settled on my face until the interval, whereupon I scarpered in shame. If I was in over my head, most of the time I just ignored the evidence. Over the year, I globe-trotted around the horn world and met the top players from Los Angeles to St. Petersburg. The consensus among soloists and section players was that I had probably bitten off more than I could chew in a year. But if I was to persevere, it would be a good idea to get a feel for playing in front of an audience. The first time I gave a public account of K447, Mozart's third horn concerto, the small gathering of listeners were mostly under 12. That didn't prevent the instrument from juddering in my hands as if in the grip of a poltergeist. My daughters and nieces and nephews listened for 15 interminable minutes as I sacrilegiously overrode Dennis Brain piped through the speakers on my MP3 player. The weeks and months whistled by. Eventually, I was left with no further alternative but to return to the British Horn Society's annual festival and walk on stage, alone, in front of some of the best horn players in existence. As nuts and bolts came loose in the early part of my performance, I screamed abuse at myself behind an impassive face. But I do also remember thinking that while this feels like a disaster now, it will probably be worth writing about. When people ask me what I got out of playing Mozart in public, the answer comes in several parts. I basked in the warm glow of applause, which we all need now and then. I also had the equal fulfilment of describing my musical journey. And then an actor called Jonathan Guy Lewis asked me if we could make a play out of it. Every time audiences cheer Jonathan playing me, playing Mozart, an original hunch of mine is reconfirmed. This is much more than my story. There is a silent army of lapsed musicians out there who carry a cargo of regret deep into middle age. I always say the same thing to them. You can always go back and have another go, you know. If I can, you can. I very much doubt you'll regret it. They're the ones who ask me, but do you still play? To which the answer is, I do. But not with quite the same intensity. I meet up with another returning horn player for duets and drinking. In private, it's permissible to do both at the same time. And I'm slowly working on Beethoven's Lone Horn Sonata, the one composed for the great Giovanni Punto. A friend has been given the piano part. We'll meet up at some point, once I've conquered the nasty crop of semiquavers towards the end of the first movement, and perform to an audience of none. I played in public for the last time at a gathering to celebrate the publication of my book. There's an arrangement for 8 horns of Mozart's most popular horn rondo, the one Flanders and Swan turned into the song from which I got my title. I found my horn. That evening, I hired some horn students to be my backing band while Dave and I shared the solo part. As we all stood on a small raised stage in front of my family and friends, galloping through this glorious and much-loved hunting tune, there was only one thought running through my head. It doesn't get any better than this. Thank you.
Jasper Rees was reading his essay in the series When Writers Play, and of course we heard his performance at the end there too. There's no programme tomorrow as we have a late night prom by the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, but the essay returns on Friday evening when it's the turn of historian Neil Ferguson. That's at the same time, 11 o'clock on Friday evening here on BBC Radio 3.
A celebration of the genius of Stephen Sondheim. An amazing cast perform songs from some of his best-loved shows with the BBC Concert Orchestra and conductor David Charles Abell.
Well, Stephen Sondheim creates a unique sound world for each of his musicals. I mean, for A Little Night Music, it's the world of the Viennese Waltz. For Sweeney Todd, it's sort of shock horror movie music. And for Company, it's a 70s contemporary sound. It's going to be a joy to create all those worlds with the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is the ideal instrument to do all those different styles.
Sondheim at 80 in the BBC Proms, Saturday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
11:15 now, and now Late Junction with Fiona Talkington.
Vintage South African music from the Umbakanga tradition, which in Zulu literally means steamed mealy bread. So it was the music of the people, the Umgababa Queens and Maputi. And welcome tonight to Late Junction. There's more from WOMAD later on at around 12:30 from a fabulous Finnish duo who were on the Radio 3 stage on Saturday, the accordionist Markku Lepisto and bass player Pekka Lehti. And this band was how the two met.
I ja sykkä synnyntäsi maan kavala kasvantasi, maaston muutkin matoset kirjavatkin käärmehet. Enpä tiedä karvoasi, mikä karva lienetkää on, vaikka yhdeksi karva, musta karva, harmia karva, vaikka vasken karva. Pirun riivattu purjaet, veri miun vereläet, liho miun lihalasiessa, haselkä sisäsi ja pitkä hammas paholainen. Mänen metsähän mäelle, pakene pajun vesoille, luikera kivien kolohen, musta mato, mä mullan alle vie vaiva männessäs, kipu kova kulkeissas, noille tappo tanterille, vaino vaivoille sijoille. Puista purema paha, puista myrkky myötä myöten, äläkä enää ehätä, tule näille nurkkiloille, ruma roikalle, luikertele, pirun riivattu purjaet, veri miun verellä, et liho miun lihalasiessa, haselkä sisäsi ja pitkä hammas paholainen. Mänen metsähän mäelle, vakelle pajun vesoille, luikera kivien koloon, musta mato, mä mulla alle.
Casting ancient spells on us. The Finnish band Vartina from their CD Ilmatar from, oh, that's 10 years ago now, featuring Marko Lepistö on accordion and Pekka Lehti on bass. And Marko and Pekka, or Lepistö and Lehti as they like to be known, were on the Radio 3 stage at WOMAD on Saturday, and I'll play you something from the very beautiful duo they formed later on tonight. And there's more Finnish music later on as well. Something now from a lifetime's treasure chest of field recordings by David Fanshaw, who died recently. Words are all very well, but a man must work to be strong. Athman bin Khamis, accompanied by the uta, a one-stringed harp, expressing joy at the harvest of coconuts in Kenya.
Akadhalika kwa kike na kiumeni yapo kushikwa na humala kontumuoni upita vati kudhuma ni nani ule ni nani hae hao haya hao hao mwanangu vapembe lia kupembe Kimango sinachwe moyo keke sinizwe unga Mishani na nsumeno itindao mbele na nyumba Kurora ngoma si hata kangia katika vina Engoma Aya Engoma Ngoma Yo ngoma Yesho ngoma Nantondo Ngoma tena Ao 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 Ha ha
Twine with my mingles and waving black hair, with the roses so red and the lilies so fair, and the myrtle so bright with the emerald hue, the pale and the leader whose eyes look like blue. I will sing and my laugh shall be gay. I will charm every heart, in his crown I will sway. When I woke from dreaming, oh, my idol was clay. All portions of love had flown all away. He's left me no warning, no words of farewell.